Hi, I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is your Marketplace Money podcast for the weekend of February 8th, 2013. For those of you listening in the Northeast, you're likely dealing with Snowstorm Nemo, canceled flights, school closings, worries about shortages and power outages, and long lines in stores. I called up Jeff Klein, owner of Marshall's Country Corner in Bernardston, Massachusetts, to find out what his customers are up to.
This is Jeff.
Hey, Jeff. This is Barbara Bogave from Marketplace Money.
Hey, how are you?
How are you? What's going on there right now? And are you jaded at this point? Do you not put much credence in weather reports?
Well, I am a store owner, and I do count on the weather reports for business. So, you know, being Western Mass, snowstorms do affect us a little bit. This one obviously made a lot of people panic. People were coming out in groves thinking that, you know, we'll be out of power for a bunch of days. In Western Mass, I think they take care of the roads pretty well.
Sure.
So a lot of great plow drivers out there, and we're cleared up usually within 24 hours. So, yeah, I'm a little jaded.
So what are people buying?
The essentials, milk, bread, ice, which I don't understand why with snow, batteries, flashlights, lots of food, which I'm a little food business, so I don't have a problem with that. It definitely spurs the economy in the area.
Is there anything you wish you'd stocked up on?
Well, I knew the snowstorm was coming a couple days ago. I wish I would have got a couple more people in here to help me out. So we've been running around last couple days because we really thought today would be snow on the ground when we all got in here to work, because that's what the weatherman predicted. You know, I let a lot of people stay home because of the snow report also, so...
Is there anything people aren't buying that surprises you?
No. I mean, they're loading up on a little bit of everything. It's really... There's a lot of panic, which I don't think is needed.
And how do you see the panic?
By buying so much grocery, I mean, like I said, when the weather people report something this major, which is great 24 hours ahead of time, people get ready so they don't panic in emergency. It definitely spurs the economy around here. But it is also, weathermen are only 50% right half the time, so... Right now, how much do we really predict on snow?
I'm hearing that good old New England skepticism now.
You do. And I've only been up here 12 years.
So what do you think, come Monday, Tuesday, what's that going to be like for you?
Actually, I predict the next couple of days to be quite slow because everyone's stocked up on their grocery goods. You know, we're selling a lot of food, so people won't tend to grocery shop the next couple of days because they're going to be so loaded up and full.
And if you lose power?
My store is prepared. We have a generator. So hopefully that'll keep everything nice and fresh and keep on going. And I have done it before. And the community tends to flock my way towards the store and get whatever they feel. Last year, we had a big storm and knocked out a lot of people's energy and stuff like that. So people get scared and more prepared.
Jeff Klein, he's the owner of Marshall's Country Corner in Bernardstown, Mass. And I wish you, Jeff, whatever's good for business. Take care.
Thank you.
Most guys, when they go shopping, stuff their wallets and keys in their pockets, maybe a mobile phone. But boys, if you're stuck in one of those long snowstorm panic lines this weekend, you may need to bring a book or a newspaper or an iPad. You'll need more than pockets. Commentator Scott Kuehler has a suggestion, a man bag.
It started with earbuds. Actually, it started when receipts and cards stuffed in my wallet caused back pain. Then, burgeoning keys and sunglasses made it impossible to pull a handkerchief from my pocket. My phone created enough of a bulge that my guitar didn't fit in my lap. The earbuds, where do I put those, just pushed me over the edge. I needed a purse. Used to be I'd slap my pockets before leaving. Wallet, keys, notebook, let's go. But that was when I had no car and just a single apartment key. That was when I didn't have to hoard restaurant tabs to keep from going to tax court. Add to that now all the medications, electronica, and personal care items for me and my kids, and even cargo pants offer too little space. I tried a backpack, a camera bag, a tote, and finally settled on a nice masculine camping bag that has a handle, a shoulder strap, and about a dozen zippers. It neatly holds my notebooks, e-reader, phone accessories, and then some. I call it the Mojo Bag, or maybe a MRS. But it's created new problems. Every week, it absorbs its own weight in pamphlets, takeout menus, and other counter artifacts. And what if I'm just running out for a second? My usual pocket stuff would do me, but now half of that is in the bag. I've considered less stuff, but keys, phone, wallet, notebook? What should I be without? I wonder if I should switch to a wagon.
Scott Hewler is a writer living in Raleigh, North Carolina. His latest book is On the Grid. We promised you frequent updates on the housing market on the show. The only problem, there isn't one single housing market in this country. There are hundreds of them. We're also keeping in mind that you, our savvy listeners, have criticized us in the past for spending way too much time talking about markets on the East and West Coasts. So with that in mind, we've decided to track down experts in cities and neighborhoods all over the country. And by experts, we mean real estate agents. Well, who knows a market better, right? This week, we go to Omaha, Nebraska. Now, on paper, Omaha looks like a pretty great place to live. It's consistently rated one of the most affordable cities in the country. The Bureau of Labor Statistics says it has an unemployment rate of just 4.1%. And it's the city Warren Buffett calls home. There's that. Lisa Ritter joins us now to give us a tour of Omaha. She's owner of the real estate agency Remax Results. She's also treasurer for the Nebraska Realtors Association. Lisa, welcome.
Thank you, Barbara.
So to get us started, what's going on with housing in Omaha right now?
The number of homes on the market available for sale is lower than ever, but we still have the same number of buyers competing to get those homes. So the sellers are in a good position.
So your market's doing great, it sounds like.
The market is thriving. There are a number of short sales that are still occurring, and I see it being a little higher than in the years past. The nice thing about short sales versus foreclosures is that the sellers are still able to redeem some of their credit. You would typically see credit impacted for about 2 or 3 years versus 7 through a foreclosure. So more people are taking the time to go down that route versus just giving up.
And how about the foreclosures? What's going on there?
There are foreclosures out there. If there is one place where investors are, they are buying up the foreclosures. Typically, they are not purchasing owner-occupied homes. So that is something that get grabbed up usually with cash.
Well, tell us about one of your recent typical sales. What was the home like? What did it go for?
Typically, in Omaha, you'll have about $180,000 price range. And just a few weeks ago, I had put 4 homes on the market. Within 10 days, 3 of those 4 listings had sold and sold very, very close to full price. And those homes ranged anywhere from $50,000 to $315,000. And I think a lot of the buyers are surprised at how much they're having to pay to get into these homes.
Who are these buyers? And do you have investors buying up properties for rentals or turnovers like we do in California?
We don't have the same level of investors that you do in California. A lot of the buyers that we're seeing are people coming out of merged households. As a matter of fact, 2 of the sales that I was the listing agent on were people that were coming out of their parents' homes. Nationally, real estate projections say that we're going to continue to see that.
Well, what kind of information should buyers and sellers arm themselves with to get a good deal in the market in Omaha today? And it sounds like you're going to do well pretty much no matter what, but give us your best bet.
Yes. If you see a home you like, you need to jump on it. If you wait for a second showing the next day and it's new on the market and priced right, you're going to miss it. So you really don't have a lot of time to decide to move forward, and you're going to have to make a bid that's full price or close to it. Because if you think it's priced right and looks good, other people are too. And so if you're married to that outcome, you need to make it happen, and you need to bid full price or dang close to it.
Why do you think your city's doing so well right now?
Our economy's great. Unemployment is low. I think we have hope for a bright future, and I think people feel a lot more confidence in the economy.
Well, what do you imagine for the near future? What's the housing market going to be like in 2013?
as a broker and owner in Omaha, and I know a lot of my fellow broker owners feel this way too, we are more optimistic than we've been in a long, long time. We see things, sales increasing by 3 to 5%, which is a very healthy place to be. We don't see it exploding to where suddenly there's going to necessarily be another 25-30% increase in the number of buyers or appreciation in homes. But I think we're going to see a nice, healthy pace of appreciation.
Lisa, I can't resist. What's Warren Buffett's house like?
You know, it's a lot like his life. It's very conservative. It's not worth near what you would think. As a matter of fact, it's not that far above the average price range in Omaha, which is $180,000.
$180,000? That's a starter house somewhere else. I mean, that's amazing.
Yeah,
to me.
Yeah. You can get a nice 3-bedroom, 2-bath, 1,500 square foot home for that price, and it's going to look beautiful.
Have you sold any houses recently that were not typical?
I did recently have that chance. I listed a $1.2 million home in the Lake Zirinsky area. And interestingly enough, the person that purchased it sight unseen, and he was from the East Coast.
And what does a $1.2 million house look like in Omaha, Nebraska?
Let me tell you, it is stunning. Wall-to-wall windows, top-of-the-line appliances, a shower that would really be the size of most people's bedrooms, done in gorgeous glass tiles. So, yeah, you're going to get a ton for your money when you have a seven-figure home here in Omaha, Nebraska.
Well, after this, you might see a big population explosion. Lisa Ritter is owner of RE/MAX Results, a real estate agency in Omaha, and treasurer for the Nebraska Realtors Association. Thanks so much for this, Lisa.
Thank you so much.
How well is the housing market recovering where you live? You can keep up with the number of underwater homes state by state and compare your community with our real estate tracker at our website, marketplace.org. It's time now for your letters. That's the portion of our show where we match our listeners with a personal finance expert to help sort out their money problems. Today, author and journalist Carmen Wong Ulrich joins us from New York to talk with some of you. And Carmen, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Thanks for having me, Barbara.
So before we take calls, I would like to talk for a moment about immigration and jobs. President Obama, Washington, it's all about immigration reform right now. And of course, there's concerns about competition for jobs in an economy where so many Americans are unemployed. What should we be listening for in the debate to help us understand how immigration reform could change the job market?
Well, here's the thing. There's two conversations going on kind of simultaneously about this. And one is the job market specifically with tech, let's say, for example. So we're talking the highly educated, highly skilled, leaning towards, you know, software or science, STEM. And then we also have non-high school grad job market. Of course, the biggest conversation within the Latino community is mostly with Mexican or Latin American immigrants who come here undocumented, who work the fields, let's say. And what kind of competition is that? And I will say this, that the data points to, for the most part, Americans, since they have such command of the language, tend to go towards lower wage jobs that involve face-to-face interaction, like customer service. And those are jobs that many undocumented immigrants cannot get. So the competition isn't as strong as I think a lot of folks feel, and it tends to be very regional. But should things change, and should there be a path to basically having rights as someone who is either undocumented on their way to having some kind of work status, it really is going to make a big difference. And my feeling is in a good way. We've always had competition in this country. Isn't that what it's built on? You know, anyway, well, you can never escape the competition, let's put it that way. And for the most part, what we see is, you know, specifically in Latino community, because I'm a part of it and an advocate for it, we see that the children of these immigrants assimilate, they get an education, and so many of them are on the college path. I'm the first in my family to get a college education, and I think that that's very important to realize. And then that the children of these immigrants really contribute to this economy.
Well, thanks for this. Now, are you ready to go to the phones?
Let's do it.
Great.
Those calls.
Well, first up, we have Ricardo calling us from Cincinnati. Ricardo, welcome.
Thank you, Barbara.
You wrote to us saying that you're a recent immigrant to the U.S., pertinent to our conversation. Where are you from originally?
I'm from Portugal originally.
Ah, so what kinds of money challenges did you run into when you moved here?
Getting into the U.S. credit system, that was a challenge. And I'd say somewhat frustrating, especially because when I came, I was working overseas before, so back in Portugal. I had a credit card, I had a loan on a house, and I came here and that I went back to step zero. So my question really is, what would be the best way to break in?
You know, Ricardo, I'm thinking it's so ironic my 15-year-old gets credit card offers daily in the mail. And it's doubly ironic that in our global economy that a credit history can't cross the pond.
It is, isn't it? It's really strange. Ricardo, the funny thing is that you work so hard and you do so well, and then you come up against something like this, which makes you feel like the 15-year-old who has no credit. You know, it's just that's how the system is pretty much set up. But I think that what you need to do is the same advice that I give to students just getting out of college, is in order to establish credit, use the tools that are available to you that actually don't give you real credit yet, but add on to your credit history. The easiest one is getting a secured card. And it's specifically called a secured card because basically you put down a security deposit. And then that is your line of credit. You use that responsibly, it gets reported to the credit agencies, and then eventually the secured card extends you credit beyond that security deposit, and you build your credit score and history with that. That's the way to do it with plastic.
Oh, so it's a way to create a paper trail.
Exactly. And you don't have to, you know, use it like crazy. Just use it responsibly, and you'll see. And shop around for free on sites like credit.com, bankrate.com, all of those sites that you can basically get a comparison and look out for fees, of course. Just make sure before you sign up that you call them directly and ask them, do you report to the credit reporting agencies? Now, the other thing, that there's one little bit of good news about credit reports, is that now they're going to start looking more at things that are not tied to plastic. For example, your rent, paying rent on time. And this is really good news, especially for, let's say, students, people who haven't owned a home, that they are going to start reporting that, and that'll fall into your credit history. Because for the most part, if you're looking to buy a house and you don't utilize a lot of credit, you don't have much history. So in this way, it shows you're paying your bills responsibly.
Ricardo, does that do it for you?
Yeah, that helps. I'm say I did have that opportunity maybe to get the secured credit card, which actually took me quite a bit of time to find out about. but it just seems such a bad deal, you know, for, you know, someone that pays the bills on time. And it's like you say, it's even to get rent. And even after you rent an apartment, then it's difficult to get electricity connected or gas connected because you don't have a credit history.
Yeah, it's used to judge you and your responsibility. But I have to tell you this, Ricardo, it's hard to build it in the beginning. But once you get going, you've got it.
Ricardo, I hope you are awash in credit soon.
Be careful.
Best of luck to you. Yeah, use it well.
Thank you, Carmen.
Thanks for your call. Well, let's see what our other callers are up to. Katie is on the line from Decatur, Illinois, where she works as a part-time professor. Katie, welcome to Marketplace Money.
Hi. Thank you for having me, Barbara.
Well, so tell us, what do you do exactly?
Currently, I'm a part-time drawing professor at a private university, and I'm overwhelmed by my student loans.
How big a chunk of your income goes straight to paying off them?
A little more than half of my income.
Whoa. Mm-hmm.
So it's a pretty big chunk. And, you know, I moved back after I received my master's of fine art in 2007. I moved back to live with my family and then started teaching at a private elementary school. And I've been working part-time ever since. Usually I have two to three part-time teaching jobs at a time. And so I've been struggling to make my payments, and my parents have been wonderful. They've been supporting me the whole time. I've been living with them, and that's the only way I could pay back my student loans so far.
Well, Carmen, so what resources are there out there for
Katie? Well, Katie, first I have to ask if these are federal or private loans.
I have actually one private loan. My other loans are from Sallie Mae.
Okay.
I have about $40,000 in federal and the rest is private.
Well, thank goodness for that.
Yeah.
Because that's the good news. With federal student loans, I can't tell you how much of a fan I am simply because they are the most flexible in terms of being able to pay them back. Also, you have the option of forgiveness. The private loans, I am sorry to say, my dear, there's not much you can do with that.
Right.
Those loans are very inflexible. You can't file for deference or forbearance or forgiveness. You can talk to your private lender, explain your situation, let them know what your income is, see if they could restructure the loan. But in terms of the federal loans, there's a couple things you can do. One is the income-based repayment program. And this is the program that was just put into effect by the Obama administration last year that basically allows your monthly payments to reflect your discretionary income. So you're saying it's half your income right now. So it would go down to 10% or less of your income.
Imagine that, Katie. Just take a breath and imagine
it. I'm just trying to get it all paid off. They're, you know, I just want to be done with them. You know what I mean?
That's a trade-off. You know, yes, you're going to extend the term payment of the loan, right?
Right.
The term's going to be longer. You're going to pay more. But
right.
You do need to start working because don't forget, the years that you're not able to concentrate on building your credit, for example, or building your own life cost you in other ways. Or you can get it forgiven. You mentioned you worked in private school. If you worked in the public sector, if you taught, after a certain number of years, though, some of those balances can be forgiven, completely gone.
Okay.
So think about that, because that could be a lot of money. So you want to talk to your the federal loan administrators that you have and say, here's the community college I'm looking at. Does it qualify? How many hours do I have to put into it? And a 15-minute phone call can put you on the path to getting thousands of dollars just gone.
Okay.
Oh, Katie, I wish you so much luck.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Carmen and Barbara.
You're welcome.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Well, let's see. Who else do we have lined up? April is on the line now from, right here in Los Angeles. Welcome, April.
Thank you. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a big fan of the show.
We're lucky to have you. And I understand you're starting to think about estate planning. So what's on your mind?
I am. My husband and I started a family recently, so we thought that it would be a good time to get our legal affairs in order. And we wanted to set up a revocable living trust. We have very few assets, and we were wondering if we needed to go through a lawyer to do this or if it was safe to use one of the online services like LegalZoom.
Mm-hmm. I think I hear one of your assets right there.
The best asset of all.
How old is your child?
He's 15 months.
Oh, lovely. So you're really thinking seriously about this. I do have a question before we turn this over to Carmen. Do you already have a will?
No, we don't.
Oh, interesting. That's interesting you're thinking of a trust before a will, but I'll leave that to Carmen. And I do want to say I'm very curious about your answer, Carmen, because when my husband and I had our first child, I set up a will with LegalZoom.
Yes.
And they were a really new company then, and I always wondered if it had any legal legitimacy at all. I felt I could have gone just as well written a will on a napkin and corked it in a bottle and gone to Atlantic City.
I know, Barbara. No. Actually, you know, LegalZoom and Nolo.com as well, yes, they both. Both, especially if you don't have a lot of assets and you don't have a complicated estate. Let's say you're not a business owner, you're not looking to inherit a lot from family, you don't own a bunch of properties. Those things will hold just fine. But here's the thing. You need the will. More importantly than that trust, and I'll tell you why, because the will is what takes care of your child. Now, basically, if you don't have the will and anything happens to you guys, a judge who's a stranger is going to decide where your child goes. So, and I know you mentioned 15 months. I tell people, do this when you're pregnant. Like, just get it done and really set this up as soon as possible. I would say just, you know, the second you hang up, go on the site, get the will done. It's really inexpensive. And basically, that's a directive about your family. But for you, you said you don't have a lot of assets. The trust is useful to set up basically so that the assets that you do have, you can have a directive as to where they go. So I always advise people, especially in the beginning, just get both. Get the basic will, get the trust, and of course the living will and the living directive as well. You want to make sure it's there.
Okay, perfect.
Basically, the more protection you can have, the better. And as you grow and as you build assets and you know, may you be blessed with a very fruitful life, then you want to look into having something more formal. And I definitely advise that you and your husband have separate wills and separate trusts.
Perfect. Thank you so much.
I hope that helps out, April. And good for you for being a great parent.
Thank you.
He got the last
word. We got a goodbye.
Carmen, that is all the time we have for calls this week, I'm sorry to say. It was great hearing your advice, though, for our
Thank
listeners.
Thank you so much. Those are great questions.
Carmen Wong-Ulrich is a personal finance journalist and the author of a number of books, including The Real Cost of Living. And thanks again.
Thank you.
For those of you still looking for someone to celebrate with on Valentine's Day, you are not alone. Right now, millions of people are also looking for love in a very specific place, online dating sites. And they're willing to spend serious money to find romance. The average online dater dishes out about $240 a year for access to sites like eHarmony and Match.com. But are they getting their money's worth? Dan Slater is the author of Love in the Time of Algorithms. Hi, Dan.
Hi, Barbara. How you doing?
Oh, just great. And Kate Bergstrom is with us. She's the author of the blog Dates with Kate, all about her attempts at finding love online in Seattle. Kate, hello.
Hello, hello.
I'd like to start with you, Dan. Online dating, some charge a subscription fee and some don't charge anything. So why pay for something you can get for free?
There's something called the velvet rope theory. If you go to a really fancy restaurant or a club, the idea is that it's more, you know, exclusive and the people that you get access to are of a higher caliber. So the Match.coms of the world will say, look, yes, you pay $20 a month, maybe $40 a month to belong to the site, but we have better daters. We have folks who are more serious about it.
Well, Kate, is that your experience? Have you noticed a difference between the free and the subscription sites?
Absolutely. I think that if you have to put a little bit of effort into getting onto the site, I think they're going to take it a little bit more seriously. Not always, but it helps a little bit.
Kate, you've mostly used Match.com for your online dating,
yes.
But you thought about trying the more expensive counterpart, eHarmony. What happened?
I started to fill out their personality profile, and it was incredibly extensive. But I don't know that I was willing to work that hard. I'm willing to work, obviously, a little bit, but...
Don't you want a guy who will work that hard for you, though?
Yeah, it's a lot of work.
Barbara, I met a lot of people who are on eHarmony, and the thing that I heard over and over again was that if you are the kind of person who is patient enough to fill out 450 questions, there's a chance that you may be compatible with another person who's also patient enough to fill out that many questions.
Yes.
Well, one of the big line items in the online dating profile is, of course, occupation and salary range. Dan, how big a factor is the listed salary in people's decision-making process? And how much lying is going on?
The studies that have been done show that the actual amount of lying in online dating is not as big as you'd think. So men will tend to exaggerate their height by a couple inches. The women will tend to shave 5 or 10 pounds off their weight. As far as is money important, is your job important, it's really a person-to-person thing. There are so many people who are doing online dating right now that you'll find as big a mix within the online dating sphere as you will the offline dating sphere.
Well, Kate, how important is salary when you look at a guy's profile online?
It's not important to me. The only way that I use it is I want to find someone that is generally in my same kind of economic bracket.
Kate, have you found that you're lied to a lot by the men when it comes to salary? Or...
Yes. I don't think that people are generally outright lying, but I think that they are exaggerating the truth. And I think everybody knows that everybody's doing that in a way. So it's...
You expect it.
Yes.
Well, Kate, how much have you spent over the years on online dating?
Oh, boy. If that only I had invested that money, look where I'd be. On and off, I would say I've been doing it for 4.5 years or so. I'm not currently doing it. But I would say it's probably over $1,000 because how I think some of these sites hook you is like for Match, I think it's, you know, like $30, $35 a month, but they give you a deal if you buy 6 months. But I always trying to be optimistic. So I would just buy the 1 month at a time, which is, of course, more expensive. And then I just kept buying 1 month at a time. But I would totally say it's worth it.
Really? So what have you gotten for your $1,000 plus dollars?
If nothing else, online dating gives you a kind of confidence. It used to scare me to death to walk into a bar or a restaurant and meet a guy and try and strike up a conversation. And now it ain't nothing but a thing. Like, I can totally do that without being nervous at all.
So Valentine's Day is coming up. Is that a day to avoid online matchmaking or a good time to look?
Well, the problem with Valentine's Day is that it puts so much pressure on people to have a,
yes,
you know, a special experience.
I could see why people would want to join on around Valentine's Day, but I think you're going to get a lot of amateurs maybe, or people that are maybe going to be around for a little bit and then realize they're no longer interested any longer.
Dan Slater is the author of Love in the Time of Algorithms, and you can find Kate Bergstrom's blog at dateswithkate.com. It was great talking with you both. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And if you'd like to have some fun, we have a history of online dating for you to click through. You can take a ride in the Wayback Machine for Singles at marketplace.org. You've heard the old saying that fear and greed rule the markets. Well, it's been mostly fear over the last 5 years. Desperate for a safe place to put their money, investors have pumped more than $1 trillion into bonds since 2009. But things may be turning around. This week, the research firm TrimTab said that in January, $77.4 billion flowed out of bonds and into stock funds. That's more than in any month since February 2000. And that's got people worrying about the bond market and the possible bursting of a bond bubble. Now, before you get all fearful again, you should probably hear what Chris Farrell has to say. He's the senior economics correspondent at Marketplace. Hi, Chris.
Hey, how you doing?
Well, just great. So first things first, is this a bond bubble about to pop?
So the way I like to think about it, we're at an inflection point. Stock market, Standard Poor's 500's up 120%, more than 120% since its low of March 2009. So far this year, it's up more than 5%. There's individual investors, the numbers you were mentioning, are pouring money into stocks. So we seem to be at one of those turning points where people are going to shift attention away from bonds and towards stocks. But here's the thing, Barbara. We're entering a new zone of fear.
Oh, no. I can't take it.
If interest rates start rising, the conversation is going to shift to what is the Fed going to do? How high will interest rates go? What about inflation? And then you'll be interviewing Wall Street traders, portfolio managers, institutional investors, and they'll be saying, Barbara, I've never seen anything like this. The carnage in the market. We don't know how high interest rates are going up. So you could pretty much, you know, unfold this scenario at some point in 2013.
Okay, but here's my issue. If people start selling bonds because of this inflection to buy stock, what effect does that have on the bond market?
So you and I are on a seesaw, all right? Your bond prices on bond yields, the interest rate. As the interest rates go up, you go down. It's just a mathematical relationship. So the higher interest rates go, the lower bond prices go. Let's say you own a $1,000 bond. Got a 2% rate of interest, which is what the interest on a 10-year treasury is right now. Interest rates go to 3%. If you wanted to sell your bond in the market, nobody is going to pay you $1,000 for that 2% interest rate in a 3% interest rate market. So you might have to sell it for, you know, $900, right? And the person who buys it from you for $900, they are getting a 3% rate of interest on their $900. So it means losses for people who own bonds.
Well, is there a danger then that people will now desert the bond market wholesale in order to jump on the stock market wave? And if that happened, that would be a problem for people holding bonds, right?
It would be a problem. And I do expect there'll be a lot of activity, especially among the professional investors. But here's the thing. When it comes to personal finance and managing your portfolio, it's not about what other people are doing. This is one of those times in life when it's all about you. About your circumstances. Let's say somebody has a child going off to college in 2 years. They're 16 years old. They're going off to college at 18. Well, if you got some bonds, I would sell those bonds and, you know, put it into certificates of deposit or treasury bills or something that's very, very safe. Why take the risk? Depending on when you need the money, that will help dictate what kind of strategy you pursue.
So bottom line, know thyself. Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely. That is like, you know, that is probably the most profound phrase in all of investing. know thyself.
Chris Farrell, our resident philosopher and senior economic correspondent at Marketplace. Thanks so much for this.
Thanks a lot.
If there's one thing Marketplace's Dan Bobkoff knows about himself, it's that he loves to travel. A few months ago, he decided he wanted to go to Japan. The problem was, he has a public radio reporter's budget. So how did he manage to spend 17 days there on the cheap? Easy. He got his credit card companies to pay for most of the trip. And as Dan will tell you, he's not the only one working the system.
The electricity of Tokyo. The bells at shrines in Kyoto. Snow monkeys in the mountains. But Japan is also a $1,300 plane ticket and coach, a regular coffee for $6, and hotels for $300 a night. So to get there, I embarked on an adventure to see just how much of this trip I could get for free, courtesy of the big banks and airlines. And I found I'm one of many playing this game.
They are willing to almost try anything to maximize points, miles, or cash back from their rewards cards.
John Alzheimer is with SmartCredit.com, and he's describing people like me, extreme point hoarders, mile fiends. This trip to Japan could easily have cost $6,000 or more, but all told, for 17 days and four regions, I probably spent about $2,000, a lot of that being food and a rail pass. I started by following the advice of this man.
When we talk about miles, there's two types of
Brian Kelly calls himself the points guy and runs a website of the same name. He also leads seminars like this one, teaching people how to get the most out of an airline mile or credit card point.
But it's a lot easier than you expect.
Essentially, it's like collecting money. You know, miles and points are money. If you're not taking advantage of them, it's like taking a wad of cash and throwing it in the trash can.
For this trip, I needed every mile and point I could hoard. And I didn't actually have to travel to rack up. I signed up for credit cards with big bonus offers. One card scored me 100,000 airline miles. On another, spending $3,000 netted 50,000 points. These bonuses alone paid for most of the travel. But this hobby can become obsession. Kelly suggests as much.
There's one last term, the are you freaking kidding me look? You'll often get this from a spouse or partner that doesn't understand.
James Crawford knows that look. His fiancée at first didn't get it.
Yeah, she thought it was a little crazy that I was spending time on the phone with these banks.
She came around when his points got them upgraded to business class on their trip to Japan. I just flew coach. Clearly some people are beating me at this game. Crawford plans to pay for his honeymoon in Paris, Thailand, and Hong Kong with his points. Then again, he's a former investment banker who programmed a spreadsheet to maximize his rewards.
I have a model where I can put in the distance of the flight and the cost that I'm paying, and then also put in what credit card I'm using, and each credit card has different bonuses. And I then input what my value is for the points that I'm earning for an Amex point or a Chase point.
There's a lot of strategy here. For example, it takes far fewer Chase points to stay at a Hyatt than a comparable Marriott. Some point chasers collect their big sign-up bonus and then cancel their credit card before the annual fee. John Alzheimer of SmartCredit.com worries some will get into trouble with these games, spending too much, racking up debt, or damaging their credit scores.
If you are constantly opening new cards just because you like the sound of the newest, hottest rewards program, then the damage you're doing to your credit is pretty perpetual.
That's because every new application dings your credit score. And credit agencies take into consideration the average age of your accounts, so many new ones hurts that. But Brian Kelly, the points guy, says it hasn't hurt him. He has 20 active credit cards.
I usually get about 6, 7, 8 credit cards a year that bank me almost $500,000.
And I had to ask Kelly to grade my Japan trip.
So I give you an A because you did what you want and you made it happen.
Well, thanks. But I didn't tell him about the guy I met in Tokyo who got so many bonus points signing up for credit cards and bank accounts that he got himself an around-the-world ticket. He was off to St. Petersburg next. I guess he won that round. I'm Dan Bobkoff from Marketplace.
Most people aren't born knowing how to be smart with money. That's something you learn, often just a little too late. So how do you teach young people financial literacy before they run up their credit card bills or take out too many student loans? One way is to get them where they live, on their phones.
Mind Blown Life is a new mobile phone app. It's designed to help high school and college-age kids learn how to manage money by playing a game. You create your own avatar, and then you make your way through a simulated world full of financial decisions about spending and saving, choices we've all had to make. Jason Young is one of the creators of the app, and he joins us today. Hello, Jason.
Hi, Robert.
Well, what made you guys think of this? Have you personally had a hard time dealing with money?
Yeah. So I would say that Mind Blown Life is really the next step in a journey that began during my sophomore year winter break. I had gone home for Christmas as usual, but that Christmas was a little bit different from your typical Christmas. The day after Christmas, my family was evicted.
Whoa, that's harsh. How did that happen?
My mom had purchased her house using a variable rate mortgage. And when the interest rates began to rise, she could no longer afford to make the payments. But beyond that, in trying to actually keep our home, she accumulated tens of thousands of dollars of credit card debt. I always knew that we had money troubles, but I had no idea that it had gotten to that point. And I certainly, you know, wasn't expecting to have to leave our home the day after Christmas.
So this is very real for you. Why an app, though? Well, what does an app have over a book or a class in helping people achieve financial literacy?
Financial literacy, financial capability is really a skill, and that skill has to be practiced. And so games are very, very good at getting people to practice skills over and over again, often without even realizing that they're practicing them.
Well, it seems to me that the biggest hurdle that young people face in financial literacy is that they're young. And when you're young, you think you'll live forever, right? And things like retirement and serious bucks for healthcare are so abstract. So how are you planning to make those things real for your users?
The beauty of games is that you have accelerated time. So you get to, first of all, see the consequences of your actions. Instead of having to wait, say, 30 years, you get to see it in, you know, a few hours. So you know that, say, like not saving, you know, not establishing an emergency fund resulted in you getting evicted when you had an emergency come up and you couldn't pay your rent.
Well, so what kind of financial dilemmas or emergency situations do players face?
So an example would be anything from getting robbed to, you know, having your car break down to having your house catch on fire.
Okay, so I choose to be, say, a rapper and I get mugged?
Well, that can happen if you're walking around with a lot of money on you because you haven't put any of it into a bank account.
So what skills are you trying to impart to kids, or knowledge are you trying to impart to kids with this role-playing?
The game, although it teaches financial literacy, is not only about money. It's really about trade-offs. And so there's this happiness system in the game. And the happiness system requires that you eat, that you get sleep for your avatar, that you socialize. And so one of the cool things, I think, is that you could say, oh, I want to be a banker and I'm just going to like go to work all the time and make a ton of money. But if you don't handle all of these things, then your avatar could actually starve to death. It helps you understand that financial success is only a contributing factor to happiness, but it is not happiness.
Jason Young is CEO of Mind Blown Labs, based in Oakland, California. When Kate Bingham and Burt was a college student, there weren't any online apps to teach her financial literacy. And like many young people, she fell into credit card debt. But she came up with a unique way to get control of her budget. She started meticulously drawing all of her credit card statements by hand until they were paid off. And much of the money to pay off those bills came from Kate's art about consumerism. For 2 years, she photographed everything she bought. Then in 2006, she started drawing something she purchased every day. Many of those drawings are collected in Kate's most recent book, Obsessive Consumption, What Did I Buy Today? Kate Bingham and Burt joins us now from Portland. Kate, welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Tell us how you originally came to draw your credit card statements. What made you think of it?
This was the fall of 2004, and I had just graduated from graduate school, and I had just spent the past 28 months photo documenting everything that I had purchased and sharing it online. I was kind of this person who was very transparent with their purchases and very open with the things that she was purchasing. But then the flip side of that was that I had $25,000 of credit card debt that I wasn't telling anyone about, and it was making me ill. And so I found myself with another monthly round of these machine-generated credit card statements that looked like no human had looked at them, touched them. It was just kind of these statements of doom, essentially. And I felt absolutely powerless. In the process of trying to figure out what to do, I was also calling credit card companies trying to get my APR lowered because it was ridiculously high. I found that even though I was talking to a person, they were still reading from a script that had been automated, and I couldn't have a real personal conversation that was specific to my needs. I felt like I also wanted to draw these credit card statements with black pen, my shaky hand, and the replications of these credit card statements. I tried to humanize them a little bit more. And also, it was part kind of like writing on a chalkboard in class, like, I will not talk in class. I will not talk in class. I was kind of punishing myself a little bit, too. It was kind of a dark place.
Well, what I love about the drawings, you do see the shaky line. You see almost that anxiety about debt, but they're also very childlike, and it highlights the vulnerability you feel as someone who is in debt.
It's true. I feel like I made a lot of really stupid childlike decisions by being so far in debt.
So how did the process of drawing your credit card statements evolve into drawing something that you buy every day?
I really like elevating mundane things. Everyone kind of buys the same things and kind of buys boring stuff. So,
oh, there are things like scotch tape.
Yeah. And so it's just, I'm just trying to kind of, again, infuse a little bit of personality into these everyday items that we might take for granted.
Well, your book, Obsessive Consumption, has some blank pages that allow people to insert their own drawings of their stuff. What have people told you about how using your method has changed their spending habits?
They like it because it makes them, and this is the same reasons that I like doing it too, where it makes you more mindful of the everyday objects that you're purchasing. And also, if you keep doing it for over an extended period of time, at the end, you have this really kind of huge archive of these little snippets of your everyday life. It's a really good indication that little things add up to a lot. Other people have told me that they feel like it's a time where they can just kind of sit down at the end of the day and just kind of reflect upon what were the things that they purchased that day. What was the object that they felt like was a good purchase or was a bad purchase? And again, it turns into almost like this meditative process in a way.
Kate Bingaman Burt is a visual artist based in Portland, Oregon. Her latest book is called Obsessive Consumption, What Did I Buy Today? And Kate, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with us today.
Thank you so much.
And that'll do it for Marketplace Money this week. Let us know what you think of the show at marketplace.org, or you can get in touch on our Facebook page, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Piggy Bank. Next time, renters beware, foreclosure scams are on the rise.
And a young man came to the door and says, yeah, they actually had a lease agreement from the person that they paid cash to. I said, this property is not for rent.
Marketplace Money is produced by Patty Hirsch with Devin Maverick Robbins, Lindsay Foster Thomas, and Daryl Paranava. Our theme music was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is Deborah Clark. The Marketplace General Manager is J.J. Yor. I'm Barbara Bogave. Have a great weekend, everybody.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org, or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the Subscribe to Podcast link and never miss an episode again.
This is APM.